Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 7th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on arbitration agreements and class action litigation. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today's program is going to be moderated by Mr. William Emanuel. He's a partner at the Littler Medelson Law Firm and a member of its Traditional Labor Practice Group. He's also the editor of the firm's Traditional Labor blog. He's also in their Labor Relations Council, and he is a longtime leader of the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group. Please note that all expressions of opinion on today's call are those of the experts, and also that this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. One final note, Mr. Emanuel, our moderator, has been actively involved in the D.R. Horton case as counsel for a trade association as amicus curiae, and he filed amicus briefs in the case both before the NLRB and in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And with that, Mr. Emanuel, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. I'm going to start the program with a quick overview of the D.R. Horton litigation as background for our discussion. And after I do that, I will introduce our other two speakers. This case involves a conflict between two federal statutes. One is the Federal Arbitration Act, which requires that arbitration agreements be enforced according to their terms. And the other statute is the National Labor Relations Act, which protects the right of employees to engage in concerted activity. This conflict is a result of arbitration agreements that waive the right of employees to file class or collective actions under federal or state employment laws. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld such waivers under the Federal Arbitration Act, and it has done so even when the claims arise under federal statutes, such as the Fair Labor Standards Act, unless the mandate of the Federal Arbitration Act is overridden by a congressional command expressed in very clear terms. Nevertheless, the National Labor Relations Board has held in the D.R. Horton case that requiring a waiver of class or collective actions in an arbitration agreement is an unfair labor practice because it restricts the right of employees to engage in concerted activity. In reaching that decision, the NLRB rejected the contrary opinion of its general counsel at that time, who is Ron Meisberg, one of our speakers today. Now, the Horton decision of the NLRB has been appealed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which held argument on the case earlier this week. And another speaker today, Ron Chapman, represented the employer in that argument. Meanwhile, numerous other federal and state courts around the country have refused to follow the NLRB's D.R. Horton precedent in litigation involving the enforceability of class waivers and arbitration agreements. Just within the last week, for example, federal district courts in California and New York have both refused to follow the Horton decision. Finally, the D.C. Circuit's recent decision in Noel Canning involving the president's recess appointments to the NLRB has also become an issue in the appeal of the Horton decision. Now, it's a pleasure to introduce our other speakers. Because the D.R. Horton case arises at the intersection of the NLRA and the FAA, we have invited both a traditional labor expert and an employment litigator to speak, and both of them are very prominent leaders in their respective fields of expertise. On the traditional labor side is Ron Meisberg. Ron is a partner in the Washington office of Proskauer Rose, where he's a leader of the firm's labor management relations practice. Ron has a distinguished record of public service, having served as a general counsel of the NLRB for several years, and before that, he served as a member of the NLRB. And prior to his government service, Ron was in private practice for many years representing management. On the employment law side of our discussion is Ron Chapman. Ron is a partner in the Dallas office of Ogletree Deacons, which specializes in employment and labor law. Ron has a broad employment law practice and extensive experience as an employment litigator, including numerous class actions, and he has substantial expertise under the Federal Arbitration Act. Ron is currently representing the employer in the D.R. Horton case, and he will report to us as part of his comments on the oral argument at the Fifth Circuit earlier this week. Now, first, I would like to turn the microphone over to Ron Meisberg.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me to speak today. I want to cover three quick topics. One is I want to go over the right to engage in concerted protected activity under federal labor law. Second, I want to speak with you about how the NLRB has applied that concept in the D.R. Horton case. And third, I want to briefly discuss my role as the NLRB General Counsel in an attempt to develop a more balanced approach than that that was adopted by the board. It comes as a surprise to many employers that the National Labor Relations Act applies to their workplace whether or not there is a union. I believe it's safe to say, at least until recently, most employers assumed that if they did not have a union-represented workforce, they did not have any exposure to or obligations under the NLRA. Of course, as we've seen as a result of a number of recent high-profile cases, such as those in the social media area and these arbitration cases, that is not the case. Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act protects the rights of employees who are covered by the Act to join or form a union and engage in collective bargaining, but it also protects the right of employees to engage in other concerted activities or other for other mutual aid or protection, whether or not there is a union. Thus, if a group of employees join together to protest working conditions, or if an individual employee undertakes to prepare for group action or acts on behalf of a group of employees regarding working conditions, that activity is generally protected under Section 7 of the Act, even in the absence of a union. And Section 8A1 of the Act makes it unlawful for an employer to interfere with, restrain, or coerce employees in the exercise of their Section 7 rights. So it's this right to engage in concerted protected activities that was at the heart of the D.R. Horton case and others, presenting the issue of whether class action waivers unlawfully interfere with, restrain, or coerce employees engaged in the exercise of concerted protected activity under Section 7. Now, in one of its last rulings before Member Becker's recess appointment ended, the National Labor Relations Board held in D.R. Horton that agreements between an employer and an employee which require the arbitration of employment-related claims arising under other federal and state statutes but do not allow class actions are unlawful. The case involved D.R. Horton's mandatory arbitration agreement. Under the mandatory arbitration agreement, all employees were individually prohibited as a condition of employment from pursuing class or collective actions in any forum, judicial or arbitral. The board held that this violated the employee's right to engage in concerted activities for mutual aid or protection under Section 7. The decision hinged on four principal factors. First, the board recognized that participating in an employment-related class action is protected under Section 7 of the NLRA. This was based on board cases holding that an employer may not discriminate against employees for initiating or joining a class action regarding employment matters. As an aside, I think this is a slightly different question than whether an employer might nevertheless prospectively require an employee's agreement that he or she will not bring or participate in a class action. Second, the board held that the maintenance of the mandatory arbitration agreement was unlawful under prior board law because it explicitly restricted activities protected by Section 7, that is, the right to bring or participate in a class action lawsuit. Third, the board cited a number of pretty old Supreme Court cases for the proposition that individual employment contracts cannot waive rights guaranteed under the National Labor Relations Act. And fourth, the board cited the Norris LaGuardia Act for establishing a public policy against interference with, quote, concerted activities for the purpose of mutual aid or protection, unquote, and for its provision that, quote, any undertaking or promise in conflict with that policy shall not be enforceable in any court of the United States, unquote. Now, these provisions in Section 102 and 103 of Norris LaGuardia inform the board's view that the mandatory arbitration agreement was both contrary to public policy and unenforceable. Notably, the board distinguished the Supreme Court's ruling in 14 Penn Plaza versus Pyatt, and that where a union in a collective bargaining agreement had agreed to individual arbitration in lieu of judicial or arbitral class actions for covered employees. The board recognized that it was well settled that a union may waive certain Section 7 rights of employees it represents in exchange for concessions from an employer. The board also averred that its decision did not bring the National Labor Relations Act into conflict with the Federal Arbitration Act, which had been interpreted and applied in the U.S. Supreme Court's holding in Gilmer against Interstate Johnson Lane Corporation and its progeny. In Gilmer, the Supreme Court had held that an individual arbitration agreement was lawful so long as it did not require or cause a party to forgo substantive rights afforded by the underlying statute. The board held that its ruling was consistent with Gilmer and the Federal Arbitration Act because the mandatory arbitration agreement required employees to forego the NLRA Section 7 substantive right to engage in the concerted activity of filing or participating in a class action. The board noted that if there were a conflict between the Federal Arbitration Act and its ruling under the National Labor Relations Act, then the Federal Arbitration Act would also be in conflict with the Norris LaGuardia Act. In those circumstances, the board stated that the Federal Arbitration Act would have to yield because the Norris LaGuardia Act was enacted 7 years after the Federal Arbitration Act. And Section 15 of the Norris LaGuardia Act repealed all acts and parts of acts in conflict with the Norris LaGuardia Act. Finally, the board sidestepped the Supreme Court's decision in AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion and Stolt-Nielsen against Animal Feeds International Corp., distinguishing them principally because neither case involved employment agreements or a waiver of rights protected by the NLRA. Member Hayes was recused in this decision, and there was no dissent. Now, I was the NLRB general counsel when the first unfair labor practice charge involving the legality of class action waivers and arbitration agreements was filed. That case involved a class action waiver requirement maintained by Neiman Marcus department stores. And it was because of the Neiman Marcus case that I issued a general counsel memorandum in June 2010 in order to provide guidance to NLRB regional offices and to labor law practitioners. In that memorandum, I attempted to do what the board claimed to be doing, that is, strike the appropriate balance between the National Labor Relations Act and the Federal Arbitration Act. The difference is I paid more heed to other federal, state, and local statutes at issue, and I struck a very different balance. In the GC memorandum, I noted the Supreme Court had recognized that the right of employees to act concertedly under Section 7 includes the right to be free from employer retaliation when employees seek to improve their working conditions by resort to administrative or judicial forums. But I also noted that the Supreme Court in Gilmer had recognized that an employer may require an employee as a condition of employment to channel his or her individual non-NLRA employment claims into a private arbitral forum for resolution, so long as that forum did not impinge on the employee's substantive rights under the statute at issue. I stated that, quote, the orderly development of law under the Act and the sound exercise of prosecutorial discretion by the General Counsel demand that we take account of the long-term, well-developed body of case law in this area, unquote. My effort to strike the appropriate balance was based on a number of key factors. First, as noted, I felt it was important that we respect the well-developed body of case law emanating from the Supreme Court's Gilmer decision, which not only allowed but encouraged arbitration of employment claims, employment law claims, where the arbitral forum did not deny substantive rights under the employment law at issue. Second, and relatedly, I felt it was very important to recognize that the claims at issue in these disputes did not arise under the National Labor Relations Act, but under other federal, state, and local employment laws, such as Title VII or state human rights laws. Third, I felt that it was not the board's province to decide what was necessary to vindicate rights under those other federal and state employment statutes. The legislatures which enacted them and the officials who enforced them should do that. And as you can see, this implicates important principles of federalism, as well as comity among respective governmental bodies. Finally, I felt the board as an institution should defer to well-established judicial procedures for determining whether an employer's employment dispute arbitration system was fair and allowed employees to vindicate their rights under those statutes. Courts routinely make these judgments and can decide whether or not class actions are necessary. If they're not necessary, then an employer's system should be allowed to stand. If they are necessary, then the employer would have to reform its system to account for that. But these challenges should be decided on a case-by-case basis in the courts, as they are now, and not by a decisional fiat of the NLRB. It was my view that the only guarantee of a class action under the NLRA in these circumstances should be for the purpose of bringing a challenge to an employer's system, not for adjudicating any underlying employment claims. I felt this was the proper balance, and so stated in my GC memorandum. It was on the basis of the principles enunciated in the GC memorandum that the complaint in the D.R. Horton case was first issued. As this case and others like it are litigated through the federal court system, I hope this balancing test or something like it emerges from the process, but it remains to be seen how this will ultimately play out. I think the issue will likely require eventually the Supreme Court to once again step in and resolve a conflict between requirements of the FAA and this time the NLRA and the Norris Affordia Act, as well as the myriad other federal, state, and local statutes involved. Now, I'll turn the microphone over to Ron Chapman, who will discuss the D.R. Horton case in the Court of Appeals and what we see going forward.
Thank you, Ron. I think it'd be helpful for me to start with an explanation of my view as to why this D.R. Horton case is so significant. As most of you probably know, there's been an absolute tidal wave of litigation over proper classification of employees under the Fair Labor Standards Act, in which almost every company of any size has been sued in a class or collective action in which employees allege that they were entitled to unpaid overtime. One of the primary defenses that many employers have created to prevent that sort of class or collective action is to have an arbitration agreement that includes a class action waiver. And D.R. Horton had that type of provision in its arbitration agreement. So if the board gets its way and the board's ruling is upheld, all of those class action waivers and all of those arbitration agreements across the country are going to be invalidated with the stroke of a pen. And therefore, employers will lose one of their fundamental protections against class and collective actions. From our view, the board's decision was incorrectly decided, and we based that primarily on an examination of Supreme Court precedent, which of course the board is required to follow, although in our opinion it did not do so in this case. Many of these cases have been mentioned already. There's the Gilmer case, Concepcion, the CompuCredit case, but when you package all those together, the clear direction from the Supreme Court is that arbitration agreements are to be enforced according to their terms, absent some clear congressional mandate to the contrary. And in Justice Sotomayor's concurrence in the CompuCredit case, even Justice Sotomayor observed, if we're wrong, Congress can tell us we're wrong by amending the statute that was at issue. So in other words, if we're wrong in concluding that this arbitration agreement should be enforced, then Congress is free to tell us we're wrong by simply amending the statute and including a clear congressional mandate that claims under that statute are not subject to arbitration. And in fact, Congress has done that in several limited circumstances, but has not done so in the case of the NLRA or the Fair Labor Standards Act. Since the D.R. Horton decision was issued by the board in January 2012, 13 months ago, 27 different cases have rejected the board's reasoning. And these cases come from all over the country. California, many of them are in California, New York, Florida, Texas, Pennsylvania. And ironically, it's somewhat difficult to get courts in all of those states to agree on the color of the sky, much less a sophisticated issue of law, yet they all agree that the board incorrectly decided the D.R. Horton case. And then just a couple of weeks before oral argument in front of the Fifth Circuit, which was held this past Tuesday, just a couple of weeks ago, the D.C. Circuit issued the Noel Canning opinion, in which the D.C. Circuit ruled that President Obama's appointments to the National Labor Relations Board were invalid on constitutional grounds. If you take the same reasoning from the Noel Canning decision and apply it to Member Becker's term on the NLRB, then he shouldn't have been there to begin with. And in fact, his appointment was invalid from day one under the Noel Canning decision. So we filed a supplemental letter brief with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals raising that issue. The board responded with a motion seeking leave of court to provide supplemental briefing on that issue. The court carried that motion with the case. And what that means is the court said, we're not going to rule on this now. We'll decide later whether we want supplemental briefing or not, but we're not going to rule on it right now. So that brings us up to oral argument from Tuesday earlier this week. It was a three-member panel of the Fifth Circuit. One of the judges was a Carter appointee, one was an Obama appointee, and one was a W. Bush appointee. At the outset of the oral argument, the judges indicated they did not want the parties to focus on the Noel Canning issue and instead wanted to address the merits of the underlying NLRB decision. I think that's a good sign for the employer because, as I explained to the court, they reach the constitutional issue only if they are inclined to enforce the NLRB order. In other words, if they find that the NLRB order was incorrect on the merits, then they would never reach the constitutional issue. So the fact that they said they wanted us to focus on the merits and not the constitutional issue, I took as a good sign. At the end of the oral argument, the judges reiterated that preference and stated on the record that if they want supplemental briefing from the parties, they will let us know. So in that sense, in my mind, no news is good news. If the court does not request supplemental briefing, that's an indication to me that they're going to decide this case on the merits. And if they're not going to reach the constitutional issue, that means they're likely going to rule for the employer. But time will tell. The oral argument was only 40 minutes, but it was a very, very active court that asked lots of questions. Interestingly, Judge King, the President Carter appointee, brought up the issue of a plethora of individual lawsuits filed against 24-Hour Fitness. 24-Hour Fitness has a similar program to D.R. Horton and includes a class action waiver. It's a little bit different in a number of respects, but the general concept of the waiver is the same. And Judge King's point seemed to be all of these individual cases have been filed against 24-Hour Fitness by the same law firm. So clearly these plaintiffs in these cases are engaging in concerted behavior even without filing a class or collective action. And of course, I jumped on that topic and advised the court that that proves D.R. Horton's point to a T, that you don't need a class or collective action procedural mechanism to engage in concerted activity. Employees can engage in concerted activity in many different ways, such as hiring the same law firm, sharing resources, pooling discovery, testifying on each other's behalf. There are lots of ways to exercise their Section 7 rights to engage in concerted activity without being, quote-unquote, entitled to the procedural mechanism of a class or collective actions. So some of you may be asking yourselves, what do you think will happen? And I really don't know. You never know what judges are going to do. They certainly did not tip their hand or indicate what they were thinking to any great degree during the oral argument. I do think we have the better end of this argument. I think the 27 cases that have come out in the last 13 months prove that point. But it is a sophisticated issue, and the judges seem to be grappling with it and trying to find that right balance. And with that, I will open it up to any questions and turn it back over to Bill.
Yes, let's start with a question that I have, Ron, and that is that the Eighth Circuit has decided in the Owen versus Bristol Care case that the Horton decision should not be followed. Did that case come up at all in the oral argument?
Absolutely. I brought it up numerous times. That case was decided just maybe about a month ago. We filed a supplemental brief with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals advising the court of the Eighth Circuit's ruling. And, of course, I encourage the Fifth Circuit to follow the Eighth Circuit's decision. That case is significant because it's the only federal court of appeals to have opined one way or the other on whether the D.R. Horton decision from the board was correctly decided. So the only decision that's out there found that decision was incorrectly decided. So obviously we emphasize that to the court of appeals at the Fifth Circuit.
And would you agree that it's really a very strong decision in our favor on this issue?
Absolutely, absolutely. Of the 27 cases, and I have a running list of those cases. If anyone's really, really interested in tracking this issue, shoot me an email, and I'll be happy to send you the list of 27 cases. But of those 27 cases, many of them go into a lot of detail. Many of them do not. So the Eighth Circuit decision was important because it really did examine the merits or lack thereof of the underlying NLRB decision and took it to task.
And Ron, did the Norris LaGuardia issue arise in the oral argument at all?
It did not at all. The judges were very much focused on the National Labor Relations Act, did not even mention Norris LaGuardia. Norris LaGuardia certainly was mentioned throughout the briefing by all parties and interested parties, but it did not come up during the oral argument itself.
And Ron Meisberg, does the NLRB... It's sort of a rhetorical question, but does the NLRB have any business construing or enforcing the Norris LaGuardia Act?
Well, I think the board was not constituted to resolve questions arising under that act. I suppose you could have a debate about whether they ought to be able to look at that act as a guide to inform them on their construction of the National Labor Relations Act. And I suppose one could argue that's what they did here, but it seems to me, if you look at what they did here, they were really relying on it for substantive support, not just guidance, but substantive support for the proposition that these kinds of clauses were unlawful and could not be enforced in federal court in an effort to get around the Federal Arbitration Act. So I think they sort of went beyond guidance here and construed that law as part of the decision.
One thing that was emphasized repeatedly at oral argument by me and several of the judges was that personnel within the NLRB had taken varying positions on this issue. Prior to the board issuing its ultimate ruling, the regional director, Mr. Meisberg, another acting general counsel, and the administrative law judge had all taken a different position on the ultimate issue of whether the class action waiver is enforceable. And it proved my point, I hope, to the court that this was a new quote-unquote right that the NLRB unilaterally declared. This was not a right that had been followed and recognized for decades. In fact, just the opposite. Nobody had recognized this right up until the board issued its decision in January 2012.
I also think that when you parse your way through the very complex argument the board made under Norris LaGuardia, they conflated two different sections to reach a result that's really contrary to that statute, and also I think you pointed this out in your brief. The board ignored the fact that that the Federal Arbitration Act was recodified several years after the Norris LaGuardia Act was enacted. So that pretty much destroys, I think, the Norris LaGuardia argument. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I completely agree. And in fact, the board in its decision tried to support its ruling by noting that Norris LaGuardia was enacted subsequent to the FAA. Well, you take that same rationale and apply it to the correct set of facts, which is that the FAA was recodified after Norris LaGuardia, and the board's own rationale undercuts their argument.
Correct. We have just another minute or so before we go to the audience for questions. Either of you, Ron Meisberg or Ron Chapman, do you have any other points or any questions you'd like to ask?
No, I'm ready to face the audience.
Let's see what they have to say.
Okay, Dean, time to go to the audience.
All right, thank you, Bill. Well, let's open the floor to questions from the audience. In a moment, everyone will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any of our experts, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either or all of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Bill, it looks like we got two questions so far, but if you'll allow me, let me announce our upcoming calls very quickly.
Sure, go ahead.
To the audience. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock, we have a panel of experts who will discuss first steps in immigration reform, including the Military Enlistment Opportunity Act. That's tomorrow at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. Then next week, we've got a very full calendar of calls. On Monday, our call at noon Eastern Time will feature Ramesh Panora of the National Review and author Jonathan Last as they discuss Mr. Last's book on the effects of population on culture, the economy, law, and policy. That's Monday at noon Eastern. On Tuesday next week, we'll be discussing the Supreme Court's Georgia Pacific case, which concerns judicial deference and the EPA. That's Tuesday at 2 p.m. On Thursday, another call, we'll be discussing a dispute between the city of Tombstone, Arizona, and the National Park System. The city of Tombstone there is unsuccessfully trying to gain access to water supply lines that cross through a national park in order to repair those damaged supply lines and ensure their water supply. That's Thursday at noon. And then Friday, finally, our fourth call next week at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll discuss the Second Circuit Bronx household litigation. That's a case that involves after-hours uses of school facilities by religious-oriented groups. So I encourage folks to check the Federalist Society website for an update because that schedule is always changing. And now, Bill, we've got three callers with questions, so why don't we go to the first caller?
Well, good day. This is Robert Freed here in California. Greetings, Ron. I hope you're well. And also from Tom Lenz, just wanted to add into this discussion. Tom had oral argument yesterday in the Hyundai Merchant Marine case, which involved an equally creative intrusion into employer HR policies with respect to the confidentiality of investigations. And our oral argument seems to have followed roughly the exact same lines that the one you're discussing did. So that's my addition to the morning.
Thank you. Next question.
All right, stand by. It'll be just a slight delay as we get to the next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's examine for a second the difference between class action and concerted action. The general argument for either is centers around the more for the convenience of the court rather than any basic right of litigants. It may be convenient for litigants to save their costs, but the main argument for class action seemed to be to save the time and costs of the court. To what extent do prudential considerations and arguments bear on this question? And before I move on, a comment really for Dean, since one of the participants has invited people to send email to him, it would be very helpful if the email addresses of participants were provided in our announcements so that we could communicate with them. In most cases, they can be discovered, but it would be more convenient if they were simply provided.
Okay, thank you. I'm sure Dean will take that suggestion under advisement. And Ron Chapman, I think that question is probably within your purview. The question of class actions and whether the Rule 23 is really a procedural rule, and the statute that authorizes it is a procedural statute and not a substantive one. Would you like to comment on that?
I would. It's an excellent point. It's one we made in our briefing extensively, and that is that class actions were created by rule. They're not created by statute. Rule 23 in the Rules of Civil Procedure and state law equivalents come from the rules of procedure, not a statute. And the Federal Rules Enabling Act provides that those federal rules cannot be interpreted to amend or enlarge any substantive right. So, in our opinion, the decision from the National Labor Relations Board does exactly that. It interprets a rule of civil procedure, specifically Rule 23, as amending or enlarging a substantive right under Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, and that the Rules Enabling Act prohibits that very interpretation, and therefore we know it is incorrect.
This is Ron Weisberg. One sort of additional fill-up on that, which is the board tried to distinguish between the right to bring the action versus the right to maintain the action pursuant to the rules. We had stated in the general counsel memorandum that employers ought to be, even in a case where we said the class actions might be appropriate, and that is to attack the system, not the individual claim, but the fairness of the system, that employers should be free to argue all their defenses under Rule 23 and also the fact of the waivers themselves, so that there is no sort of unfettered right to maintain class actions. It is, as the questioner pointed out, a rule of convenience for the courts, not a substantive right of individuals to maintain those.
And the point that did come up during oral argument tags onto that, Ron, which is if there is a substantive right to maintain a class or collective action, then that means every time an employer files an opposition to class certification or a motion to decertify, that that's an unfair labor practice.
Right.
Because you're taking steps to oppose what the NLRB has now declared as a substantive non-waivable right.
Right.
Well, that clearly cannot be the case, and therefore their fundamental interpretation must be incorrect.
That was a point we did make in the GC's position.
Okay, more questions?
Yeah, Bill, at this point it looks like we've got about 20 minutes left. We've got one question pending. If you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines will be open after this next caller question.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Tammy McCutcheon. How are you guys doing today?
Hi, Tammy.
I have been interested, of course, on the Noel Cannon case, which has gotten a lot of attention of late. And it was reported, Ron, that that you had filed an extra document with the court to bring their attention to that, and that it might affect the ruling in D.R. Horton. And then in the last couple of days, we've seen Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg decide not to hold off NLRB action on the basis of the Noel Cannon case. Can you guys comment on how you think it's going to affect the D.R. Horton decision?
Well, I can weigh in on the D.R. Horton decision for sure. We did file a supplemental letter brief briefly, no pun intended, raising the issue with the Fifth Circuit. As I mentioned, they said if we want supplemental briefing on that issue, we'll let you know. I do not believe that it will affect the D.R. Horton decision, and I hope I'm right, because that means I win. They're only going to reach that issue if they're inclined to enforce the board's order and therefore have to examine the constitutionality of the Becker appointment. So my hope is it does not emerge as a basis for the Fifth Circuit opinion, because that will mean that we have won on the merits.
An example of that was the Noel Cannon decision itself, where the court first had to resolve the statutory issue before it could move on to the constitutional issue. I think that's what you're talking about, right?
Ron? Exactly. Yes, exactly. So in Noel Cannon, the employer lost on the merits and then won on the constitutional arguments. And it's established in the case law that courts should avoid opining on constitutional issues to the extent they can avoid them. So therefore, the court is required to take on the merits first before considering the constitutional issues. And the Fifth Circuit made it clear they're not going to rule on Noel Cannon without supplemental briefing. So if we don't get a request in the next day or two for supplemental briefing, I take that as a very good sign.
Yes, this is Ron. I think also the petition filed by General Clement was it was out of a 10J denial or a grant of a 10J, and the question was sort of an interesting twist on Noel Cannon, which is should a court issue a 10J in aid of a tribunal that has been held by another court not to have jurisdiction, and then also the jurisdictional the authority of the acting general counsel to even request a 10J under a delegation that they maintain became ineffective once the board lost a quorum. Interestingly, they did not raise the issue of Member Becker's authority to have voted on that November 2011 delegation.
I would not.
It's really a tangential. It's a very interesting twist, but not a direct impact as you would have in a direct review of a board decision.
And I believe that's why Justice Scalia elected not to pursue that particular case. I wouldn't read too much into that decision. I think the Supreme Court's practice over the years has been to let these novel issues percolate for some period of time and then look for a very clear-cut example of the rule before they take up that particular case.
Tammy, any follow-up?
I don't know if my mic is still open, but my follow-up was, how did you read the Justice Scalia's actions here? And you very much made me feel better that it doesn't, in your view, indicate that they're poised to overturn Noel Cannon.
That's right.
That's certainly how I read it. Yes. Exactly. That issue will get to the Supreme Court eventually.
Bill, this is Dean Reuter again. We don't have any questions pending at this point, but let me announce again, if you have a question, our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Thanks, Dean. Well, let's go back to the first question. The questioner asked about confidentiality rules. Do either of Ron Meisberg or Ron Chapman see a connection between the board's decisions involving confidentiality rules, including a big one that was just issued a couple of days ago, a connection between that and the Horton case?
This is Ron Meisfried. I do. I mean, I think they are all of a piece of the board's efforts on a lot of different fronts to expand the notion of what is protected activity and expand the notion of what's interference with protected activity. The board and D.R. Horton actually cited the sort of lead case, the Lutheran Heritage Village case, which is the same case that addresses the legality of handbook rules. It's the same case that's used to underline the board's assessment of social media policies and other types of rules maintained by an employer. So I think these are all very much related and all part of an effort by the board and the acting general counsel to enhance this area of the law.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think they're all part of the same theme, which is the board overreaching its historical bounds and looking for ways to remain or even become relevant in some circles. I will say I think it's a bit of a different legal analysis, because in the D.R. Horton issue with the class action waiver, it's very much enveloped with the Federal Arbitration Act, which provides this whole line of Supreme Court precedent supporting the enforcement of arbitration agreements according to their terms. So I think the legal analysis is somewhat different, but the overarching theme of board overreaching is very much the same.
And speaking of board overreaching, it seems to me that there is a long line of cases. I know we addressed them in our amicus brief, and I think you did too, Ron. Cases that hold that the board does not have the discretion to interpret or enforce other statutes or decide how other statutes should be applied. That's beyond the scope of its discretion under the National Labor Relations Act. What's your reaction to that concept as far as this case is concerned?
Well, it's obviously 100% correct, since I did include that in my brief as well as your brief. But I also think it's a distinction from the confidentiality issue, because in the D.R. Horton case, the board was obviously interpreting the Federal Arbitration Act as part of its analysis, and therefore its decision is not owed any deference by the Court of Appeals. Contrast that with the confidentiality issue, and arguably that is more within the four corners of the NLRA, which the board is authorized to interpret, and therefore may be subject to a higher level of discretionary review.
Ron Meisfried, any reaction?
I think those are all accurate observations. But my principal concern at the time as general counsel was the notion that none of these claims that are filed that are subject to these arbitration agreements arise under the National Labor Relations Act. They arise under, Title VII. They arise under wage and hour laws. They arise under a variety of state and local equal employment opportunity type laws and so forth. And this was the board reaching out in a way that I thought was not supportable to essentially say, listen, with respect to every one of those types of claims, you've got to permit a class action. And all that was done in the face of the large body of case law, which said, you can channel these kinds of claims into arbitration without class action. It only depends on whether the rights under those laws are being affected by an arbitral forum or the lack of class action. So I just felt like the board had totally misplaced it had asserted primacy of the right under Section 7 without a due consideration for the rights of created under these other statutes and for the legislatures that created them and the people who enforce them.
Bill, this is Dean Reuter again. We've got about 10 minutes left, and we've got two more questions now from our callers. Should we go back to the callers?
Yes, please do.
All right.
Hi, thank you all for doing this today. I have a quick question with regard to a previous question dealt with the difference between class and concerted action. My question is, regardless of how this Horton case comes out, I'm curious if you see any difference in application to nonprofits or even religious nonprofits with regard to mandatory arbitration agreements.
Ron Chapman?
Interesting question. No, I don't. I'd have to think about that a little more, but off the top of my head, I would say no.
Be sort of interested in what the – I'm with Ron on that. I don't know that I would, just on the basis of this quick consideration of it, know that there would be any difference in it, but I'd be sort of interested in what the underlying thought was to that question.
Yeah, could you elaborate?
Well, I'm just curious whether, you know, when I'm looking at the different cases and dealing with class actions of large employees, whether, you know, there's, I know that at least several nonprofit entities that have not only mandatory arbitration agreements, but religious mandatory arbitration agreements with employees. And as far as an application of the NLRB, then taking jurisdiction over, you know, over those agreements, even in a large nonprofit context, whether there would be any.
Yeah, I think that goes more to, it's more of obviously a kind of a First Amendment question.
Right.
And also
right.
The, you know, there's a pretty large body and a developing body, by the way, of board law on the right of the board to sort of require religious schools to allow individual professors to unionize as a result of to the extent they have a confessional obligation with respect to their professorships. And so there's no question that if you can raise that kind of a First Amendment claim, you may raise some questions as to whether a board can legally apply any kind of ruling to you.
Yeah, so I think
it's a jurisdictional question at the board rather than a question involving class actions or mandatory arbitration agreements.
And you're right, whether the board has jurisdiction to impose, for example, the right to unionize, Catholic bishops' line of cases, and they're up there right now. You know, you have, for example, a Catholic school. I just use Catholic schools as an example because they're an easy one to understand. But you know, to the extent they employ people who are cleaning crews, you know, that's one set of issues that those folks probably. Are going to be subject to board jurisdiction, but to the extent they employ people who are ministers or people whose job it is to advance the faith in their teaching and so forth, that may be a very different set of rules.
So the bottom line is that unless you can establish that the board doesn't have jurisdiction over a certain nonprofit because it's religious in nature, putting that aside, and that's a pretty rare case, but. Putting that aside, then the answer is that nonprofits aren't any different from the other employers as far as this D.R. Horton issue and mandatory arbitration agreements is concerned.
Bill, looks like we have a final audience member question. Should we take that one now?
Sure.
All right.
In the D.R. Horton case, I believe the Department of Labor and the EEOC filed briefs, amicus, at least before the NLRB. So this seems to be the viewpoint of the entire enforcement regime on the labor and employment side of the government. Do you think a decision reversing the NLRB will also chasten the Labor Department and or the EEOC? Thank you.
No. I don't think those agencies are so easily deterred, and the board has already announced that you know, even if the Fifth Circuit slaps us down, we're going to continue to enforce our decision in other circuits. So I don't think until the Supreme Court clarifies this issue, which it will eventually, I don't think any of those agencies will be deterred.
I agree with Mr. chat.
Yeah, they're going pretty wild. I don't think they'll slow down for quite a while. Ron Weisberg, do you have anything to add on that point?
No, I do think we see, as we've seen in the persuader regulations, those of you who do any sort of work involved in NLRA representation cases, now every time a lawyer enters an appearance on behalf of a company in one of those cases, he'll get a letter not from the labor board, but or in addition from the labor board, you'll get a letter from the OLMS office at the Labor Department. Reminding him of obligations under the persuader laws, which are, we fear, are about to be broadened quite a bit. So I think there is a sort of an unprecedented level of cooperation among not just the what I will call the politically responsible agencies, the cabinet-level agencies, but the independent agencies as well. It's pretty well coordinated, I think.
I had one other question for Ron Chapman. There's a little known case called Sonic Calabasas, which the U.S. Supreme Court decided summarily by just vacating a decision of the California Supreme Court and remanding it. And the case involved a California Labor Code provision and whether a mandatory arbitration agreement should apply. And the California Supreme Court said it should not, and the Supreme Court disagreed, and as I said, simply vacated the decision. Did that case come up at all in the oral argument, or has it been involved in your briefing?
It did not come up in the oral argument. I cannot recall if it's in any of the thousands of pages of briefing that has been submitted in this case. I don't recollect that it has. I think instead the parties focused on the very lengthy and very well-reasoned opinions from the Supreme Court on the issue of enforceability of arbitration agreements. But that sounds like that case would be another in the long string of cases from the Supreme Court promoting the use of arbitration agreements.
Right. I think it's important in one respect, and that is that there's this constant refrain from the NLRB that Concepcion does not apply to employment cases. I mean, that's been, you know, really debunked all over the place now, but they're still maintaining that. And the Sonic Calabasas case was indeed an employment case, and I think it's significant for that purpose. So, Dean, are we running out of time?
We're just about out of time, and we're out of questions. So this might be a good time to conclude our call.
Unless does either of the other speakers have any the burning issues you want to take 1 minute on before Dean signs off?
I thank the Federalist Society for this opportunity. I did mention people can email me for a list of the cases rejecting the D.R. Horton decision. You can find me at Ron Chapman. ron.chapman@ogletreedeacons.com, or just go to the Ogletree Deacons website and submit it through there.
Okay, I'd like to thank both of our speakers. You both did a great job, and I think it was a very interesting discussion. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Dean.
Well, thank you, Bill, and let me take the opportunity to thank our moderator, Bill Emanuel, for joining us today, and both of our experts for sharing their thoughts. To our audience, once again, I invite you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call. That's scheduled for tomorrow at 3 p.m. When we'll be taking a first look at the limited immigration reform measure, the Military Enlistment Opportunity Act. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.